Welcome to another edition of Now is the Time with Steve Berkson on Hebrew Nation Radio. Now is the Time is a production of MTOI, Messianic Torah Observant Israel. For more information, visit mtoi.org. Now, here's Steve.
All right, so today we are in part two of Get Out the Leaven. I want to start off by reviewing what we covered in part one on Monday. On Tuesday. And in part one, we came up with a definition that leaven is an element that produces an altering or transforming influence. Leaven is an element that produces an altering or transforming influence. This is what helps take your dough to make it so that it can become a nice, big, fluffy bread. All right? Now, we looked at the instructions in Exodus chapter 12 and other places that had to do with the feast that we're keeping right now called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the instructions to eat unleavened bread, but we had some points, and I'm going to just remind you of these points because we're going to tie them back together by the time we finish the teaching. We were told that we are to cause the leaven to cease in our houses, so there needed to be no more leaven in the house, and also that we were to understand that if we were still eating leaven, we would be cut off. So this leaven, whatever it is serious enough to get you cut off from Israel. We also were told that they took their dough when they left Egypt, when they left Mitzrayim, they took their dough with them before it had gotten leavened. So now we have this idea that why would he just remind us that they took their dough, which is their bread, okay, and we know metaphorically that Yeshua is the bread of life, and that we also understand that bread has to do with what sustains you, okay, even though we know you can't just live on bread, but you know, it's thought of as a metaphor for food, for that which sustains you. And so they took this sustaining element out of Egypt before it got leavened. Okay, and the idea being that whatever was in Egypt would leaven the bread. This is the idea of come out of for my people, lest you get the Babylon leavening in there, or the whatever it is, that worldly leaven get into your bread. It says they did not delay, so the bread, the dough, couldn't get leavened. So the instruction there, and we're going to connect this back together, is that you got to be aware of dawdling around. You know, my mother used to always use that with me. Well, come right home, don't dawdle. Oh, I was a good dawdler. And so I was in trouble all the time. But you know what? Dawdling will cause trouble for you, because if you delay, what happens is the bread can leaven. You see, because the leaven is so pervasive, it's so available, just like real leavening. If you take dough and just lay it out, the Jewish community believes that within 18 minutes, it starts leavening. That's not a long time. Just from the air, within 18 minutes. So you can't even dawdle 18 minutes. We're going to connect this together once you understand what leaven is. You don't want to hang out where leaven is for very long, because if you do, you might get leavened. And if you get leavened, you might get cut off. Is this making sense so far? All right. And it says they didn't stand around long enough for their dough to get leavened. In other words, they didn't delay and they weren't sticking around for that leavening to start happening. But then it also says that they had not prepared food for themselves. This is all in Exodus 12, verse 34 and 39. So they hadn't prepared food for themselves. So they were going out and stepping out into a place where they were going to have to completely trust on the Creator who had brought them out to provide the food. See, we're really kind of big on providing for ourselves. I'm going to study that for myself, and I'm going to figure it out for myself, and I don't need anybody to help me or provide for me or do any of that stuff. We get that way. So they hadn't prepared food for themselves. They were ready to go out and receive and follow instruction to where the food was going to come from. And we're told lastly in Exodus 13, as we kind of go through this review, that we are to remember the day that we were rescued from slavery, because the leavening had something to do with the slavery. So we're supposed to remember the day we were rescued out of that and to not eat leaven anymore. So something about leaven enslaves. Something about leaven enslaves. So I just want us to keep those metaphors in place. We did talk about cleansing out the old leaven. Okay, so we want to make sure we're getting that leaven out of us and replacing it with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. I'm not sure, maybe we didn't read that last on Tuesday. Well, we can read that today. Let's go to it right now. 1 Corinthians. We'll look at that real quickly. In 1 Corinthians, and we're going to go to chapter 5. Just want to remind us of what was going on here. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And we're going to read verse 6. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6 says, "Your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the entire lump?" I think we covered that. Okay? "Therefore, cleanse out the old leaven so that you are a new lump." So we're all a bunch of lumps. "As you are unleavened, for also Messiah, our Passover, was offered to us." Now listen, it says, "So then let us observe the festival, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of evil and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." So now we're going to realize and connect that the unleavened side is sincere and filled with truth, and the leavening, we can assume then, is the opposite. It's insincere and doesn't have the truth. So these are connections we're making about this word being used called leaven. Then we went to Luke chapter 12, and we defined leaven. So let's just go there real quickly just to remind ourselves, and then we'll get into Matthew 23, which is where we're trying to get to. So in Luke chapter 12, it says at the end of the chapter there, the end of the verse there, it says, "He began to say to his taught ones first, but he said, 'Beware the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy.'" So he defined for us that when he is talking about leaven, he's talking about hypocrisy. So now when we go back and think about the idea that they were not bringing hypocrisy out of Egypt, they were not bringing hypocrisy with them into what they were doing as they were being rescued out of slavery. And so I'm going to propose that hypocrisy might lead to some sense of enslavement. Hypocrisy may ensnare you and make you feel trapped. I mean, this is what they were rescued out of, was a world and a place filled with hypocrisy. Because I don't know that there can be much more hypocritical than taking a thing made of stone and saying it's the Creator, and not acknowledging the truth of the Creator. Or taking something made out of wood, or taking, you understand what I'm saying? And this is a big part of that. And then we understood that as he's talking about hypocrisy, that this was the main point of Matthew 23. So turn there, and that's where we're going to actually begin today, is in Matthew 23. And so we saw that there are 7 places in Matthew 23 where Yeshua says, "Woe unto you, Pharisees, you hypocrites. You scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites." And now he's going to describe some of what they were doing that was hypocritical. And so what I want us to do is go through this section here in Matthew 23. And while we're doing it, I want you to ask the question, what does this look like today? And more importantly, what does it look like in my life? How would this be me? Where can I end up being that? So I might hear those words, "Whoa," so that I can fix it. Let me be willing to be aware of it so I can straighten it out. And so let's begin in verse 13. In verse 13 it says, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees." Now remember, this is in this, I really want to backtrack just for a second. This is in the context of self-aggrandizing and self-exalting. So verse 12 and verse 11 make that point leading into verse 13. "The greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted." So hypocrisy often takes the form of exalting self. Now, you may think, but I don't think very much of myself. That's not always what that looks like. Needing to have your way can be self-exalting. Needing to have things the way you want them to be and you prefer them to be can also be self-exalting. It doesn't mean that you walk around feeling, "I'm so great." It doesn't mean that you walk around where everybody needs to look at you. You could be the one that people kind of can miss because you just don't look for attention, and still have an exalting problem when behind the scenes you need everything to be the way you need it to be. Because because now it's you that's important. See, you've exalted yourself to be more important than everybody else and everything else that's going on because you want it a certain way. Okay? So now he says, woe unto you, you scribes and you Pharisees, you hypocrites. And he says, you're hypocrites because you shut up the rain of the heavens before men, for you do not go in, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Shutting up the kingdom of the heavens before men by neither going in nor allowing those who are entering to go in. What does that look like today? I think what it looks like today is, let's understand what he's talking about. He says, okay, you're shutting up the kingdom before men, and this is how you're doing it. You're not going in yourself, and then you're preventing others to go in. So there has something there to do with, I'm guessing, a door or a path or some way to enter. When you enter something, how do you enter? You approach, and then you go through some sort of a door or an entrance way. He says, you guys are not going in. And I'm going to say that that's probably because they were going somewhere else. They were going in a sideways direction. They didn't stay on the straight path, which he says, do not turn left or right. Because if you turn left or right, guess what? You're not going to end up in the destination that you had thought you would end up in. So they were talking the good talk. It'd be like, okay, we're here in Tennessee, and I'm telling you that I would like to go to Florida, and let's go, and we're all going to go to Florida, and you guys all want to go to Florida too. And then I start heading north. Now I'm talking the good talk, and I'm telling you all about, you know, we're going to go through Atlanta and Georgia and all the stuff and what it's going to take. We're going to have to get on 75 or 95. And so I'm talking all the good talk, but I'm heading north. So are we going to enter in? I'm not going to, and neither are you if you're following me. Even though I'm talking it pretty good, but we're heading the wrong way. So I think we need to worry about and understand that, are you guilty of this? Are you talking a good talk but not walking it, and people are following your example more than they're listening to the words? Because remember the old saying about, your actions are so loud I can't hear what you're saying. Okay? Actions speak so loud I can't hear what you're saying. If you have children, you know about this. Your children are not going to be doing what you say. They're going to be doing what you do. And sometimes you wonder, why are they doing that? Because you do. But I never said that they could do that. Yeah, but you do it, and they watch you. Husbands, your children watch how you treat your wives. Wives, your children watch how you treat your husbands. If you're not giving each other respect, why are you surprised when your children don't give you respect? They just think you're not being respectful is normal. We set the examples. You tell them they can't use certain words, and then you use them yourself. Hypocrite. Why is it okay for you? I'm an adult. Come on. Are you going to be any feeling better about it when they turn to be quote unquote an adult and they're still doing it and then they start doing it? No. What you're saying is, I exalt myself. I can do it, you can't. Because I'm special. I get to do what I want, but you don't get to do what you want. Well, guess what? We all get to do anything we want. But our Heavenly Father is going to judge whether that was right. And he's going to say, if you had done what I told you to do, you'd have gotten better results. He doesn't like the hypocrisy. He says, you shut up the rain because you don't go in, nor do you allow others to go in. So what else does this look like? Well, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are very controlling in how they teach. They, you know, if you post something on the internet, if you post something on Facebook, some of the Facebook trolls, and I call them that because, like the fable about trolls, they sort of hang out under the bridge waiting to pounce. And as soon as you type something in, whoom, right? We all know what I'm talking about. And some of you do that. Do you know that there are some of you that when I approve a post in the MTOI group page, and I only approve posts if I'm going to respond to them personally or if it's just a general, like, feel good thing, something good and positive, something that doesn't need a response. But if it needs a response, I approve it, and then immediately I go to respond it so that all of you can read the question and the answer, and there are some of you that respond before I can. That's how fast you're waiting to pounce. Why? If you're in a group with a teacher, why wouldn't you wait for the teacher to respond? People say, oh, you're just controlling. No, there's an expectation of the people in the group to want to know what the teacher has to say. You know, I don't know if it's cultural, okay? But let me just tell you a little bit from a, and maybe the military was like this as well. I'm going to only assume. But in the martial arts, and I know there's some of you that are freaked out just because I said martial arts. Oh, well, stop all that. Okay? I'm just telling you something I learned from an experience. You guys all have experiences that you don't do anymore that you learn from. Okay? But what I did learn was, I can promise you, when my teacher was in the room, nobody but my teacher was answering a question unless he's the one asking the question. Nobody was speaking except the teacher unless he told you you could speak. Everybody know what I'm talking about who's been in the martial arts? Is that the same way in the military? Okay? Whoever's the high rank comes in the room and somebody asks a question, they're all looking to the high rank to answer the question. He's the one that's going to say yay or nay and how it needs to be. We don't have that respect anymore. We all think we need to jump in and show everybody how smart we are. That's exalting ourselves. That's not to say we can't have a discussion, but we should learn the respectful protocols. Now, I did post on our group page, just to make it easier for you, and this isn't about the group page, I'm just using an example, you know, a protocol that says, hey, give the teachers a chance to at least answer first. And then if you have a comment or additional thing, then go ahead and we can have a discussion. Okay? Now, that's not to say that you can't go into these other groups that are just free-for-alls. I mean, there's hundreds of them. You want to just go at it, then go into one of those groups. They're happy to have everybody just go at it. But this is a group page that has a group structure, and people are interested in what the leadership has to say. That's why they're asking the question. And it's not just because they're just going to blindly follow the leadership. Maybe they're vetting out the leadership, and they want to know, what does the leadership think about this? And so it's a vetting question. Hey, I got this issue. I just want to know where you stand on it. And so I'll answer it so that everybody will hear at the same time, here's the issue, and this is where we stand on it as a ministry. And there's value in all of that. But you know what? What if you start coming up and becoming the teacher and needing it in an exalting way to be the way you need it to be? And everybody has to agree with you. And notice I didn't say that in the group page everybody has to agree with me. I just said you have to allow me to answer the question first so that at least that's officially answered, right? Because also people in the group may assume that you speak for the leadership. Do you want that responsibility? Especially if you actually are not part of the leadership? Because, see, what happens is you could inadvertently be shutting up because you're not going in and you're not allowing others to go in. Because you've decided you're right and everybody else is wrong on a particular topic, and you're going to stand there and make that your thing, you know? And that's what you're going to go and hammer home with everybody you meet. I'll give you a hint. If you've got any particular subject that you generally talk to everybody about, there's a problem. Okay, I'm not just talking about like messianic, Hebrew roots, Torah observance. I'm saying if there's a single piece of doctrine or your walk that you tend to talk to everybody about, you probably have a problem there. That's inside of you that you're not dealing with well because you need everybody to agree with you on that one or two things. Is it making sense? Okay. Because why are you talking to everybody about that one issue, except that you're trying to bring them all onto your side, onto your page? I mean, is there any one piece of the walk that's that important that you talk to everybody about that one piece? No, I talk to everybody about the fact that they want to start walking. Let's walk this walk. And there's lots of pieces to this walk. How you treat me, how you treat your Creator. There's pieces about how you eat. How you work, right? It says, give an honest day's work, honest day's pay. All those, I mean, there's all kinds of pieces of this walk. We tend to micro-focus, though, on the one or two pieces that we get emotionally invested in. And if you get emotionally invested, now you've got an exalting issue going on. Think of that. If you get emotionally invested, and by the way, that's why you get offended when people don't agree with you, because now you're emotionally committed to that idea. Because now what's happened is that idea has become a part of who you are as an identifying piece. And once it becomes a part of who you are, you've exalted yourself in some way. Because now you are synonymous with this idea or this piece of Torah, this piece of walk. You see how you can be involved in all of this? You have to be really careful. He says, because this is a hypocrite thing. Because we start telling people, well, if you don't do it this way, you're not getting in, or you're not doing it this way, you're not doing it. We start almost threatening people and pressuring people. Oh, no, well, you're in sin. You know, I probably have almost never, I'm trying to think, unless someone asked me specifically if I thought it was something they were doing was sin, I don't think I've ever told anybody that what they're doing was sin. Who am I to do that? I could tell them, well, I think you might want to rethink about this or check this out or go, you know, whatever, consider. But to actually, and I know people out there come to me and say, oh yeah, they told me I'm in sin and they told me this and they told me that because I'm doing this. Why are we doing that? Who made you judge? It's a self-exalting thing again. We got to be really careful with that. Because, yes, I know a lot of you are doing things, including me, that are sin. We all fall short. It says everyone falls short on a very regular basis, sadly. We do. If we're falling short, it means we're sinning. You don't need me to tell you that. I don't need you to tell me that. But if you ask me, hey, I'm facing this situation. If I make this choice, do you think I would be in sin? Then I can give you my opinion because you asked. That's very different than if you didn't ask. You just happened to be talking to me and said, oh, no, that's sin. What I might say to you is, hold on, let's rethink about this because I think that could be a problem. That could be breaking a commandment. And then we could work that through. It's a very different approach. But see, you're not going to be able to do that if you're emotionally invested. If you're emotionally committed that this thing, if other people aren't doing it and you're doing it, hurts you because it's part of you. It's like when they deny that idea that you have, it's like they're denying you. If they discard that idea as being wrong, it's like they're telling you you're wrong. Because people are now identifying with a positional idea or a doctrinal idea. That's why the Christian churches attack you so hard when you walked out. Because they take it personally. How many of you have family members that when you stop doing certain things, they said, oh, you're judging me. Did you judge them? No. Did you say anything about them doing it? No, you just said you weren't doing it anymore. But you see, because they're emotionally invested in the idea, in the ritual, in whatever it was, Christmas, Easter, Sunday, whatever it was, they're so emotionally invested in it that when you said, I'm not going to participate, you now told them that you're telling them that they're wrong or that you're judging them. But you're not doing any of that. But because they're connected to it as identifying who they are, they took it that way. They took it as you're rejecting me. Oh, you think, well, because if you decided it's not good enough or it's wrong for you to be doing, well, then obviously their brain goes, well, then you probably think it's wrong for me to be doing it. Well, of course, that's a right conclusion. But I also know that until I had my eyes open and my ears and my heart and all that stuff open, I was doing what you were doing, and so you have to wait till you get yours done. Right? So let's be careful, especially to the leadership. If you're in leadership, are you walking in hypocrisy where you're shutting up the heavens because you're not going in and you're not letting everybody else go in? Let's go to verse 14. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you eat up widows' houses and for a show make long prayers. Because of this you shall receive greater judgment. Greater judgment. Eating up widows' houses. Greed. Greed. This is more to the leadership. We see this today, don't we? We see this in ministries, both Christian and Messianic. Greed. You know, just go ahead and send in your whatever and we'll send you the anointed Ten Commandments tablets or the anointed whatever. You know, it's one thing if people want a nice set of stone Ten Commandments tablets and they're going to spend, you know, $30, $40 because that's what it costs. It's another thing if you're sending in a $1,000 donation for a $30 piece of Ten Commandments. You know what I'm saying? This is where it gets to be greed. It says here that they're eating up the widow's houses. So I think there's a hint in there that there's this idea of preying on those that are weaker. And I see this, by the way, with the first problem we were dealing with, where people with their pet ideas and doctrines and stuff tend to go into congregations and prey on those that look like they're easy targets. Because those people, just like the criminals out there that will rob you, they're going to look for the easy victim. You know, if you're a relatively large and you look in good shape and you look confident and you're walking by and someone behind you doesn't look so healthy and in shape and has got a little, maybe a limp going on and doesn't look all that intimate, they're going to go for that one. They're looking for the easy target. Well, guess what? When they come in your congregations and when they find you, do you look like an easy target? Because that's what they're going to do. And he says, look, they're eating up the widows' houses. You've seen this in the Christian ministries, what they do with widows and how they manipulate them emotionally because they have great need. So I would say that a widow metaphorically is those who are not self-grounded. When I say they're in themselves, they're not grounded and solid, but they're susceptible to needing others to reaffirm that they're have that weak part of them, is that they are susceptible to the emotional manipulation of others because they need others to validate them and to encourage them. And so they become easy victims to these things. So you've got to know who you are in Messiah, not exalting yourself, but you've got to know who you are, and you also have to know who is there to cover and protect you. This keeps going back to leadership. You must have, to protect you from all of this, leadership that it knows who you are and you know who they are, and they can help protect you when wolves come around looking for easy prey. See, if you're uncovered, there's nobody there to stave off the wolves. But you see, these hypocrites, they were eating up the widows' houses and they were making a show of long prayers, long showy prayers. Look, we've said the blessing after the meal, every meal we've been here, and it's been short, hasn't it? It's right to the point. Doesn't have to be long. I don't have to try to impress anybody. And some of you, when I've handed the mic to pray, have done some very straight and to the point, you know, relatively short prayers. And I like that you did that, because we don't want to just all stand there forever during a long prayer. But also to show others that you don't have to say a lot of words to be effective. So, because when you start saying a lot of words, now you're being showy. Unless there's an important reason. I mean, I've been with people that when they prayed before a meal, they prayed for everything they could think about, including the meal. And you could be there for 15 minutes. Anybody seen some of those? I love my father-in-law, but he'll do that. He's going to, again, part of it is because we're not always there. So as long as we're there, he's going to pray for everything he wanted to say about it, his daughter and me and the family and everything else. But he's not doing it to be showy. But you got to be careful if you are. Are you trying to impress people because you can do an impressive prayer? It says, because of this, you shall receive a greater judgment. Now, when you see the phrase greater judgment, what should we be triggering? We talked about it during the Midrash today. We talked about it the other day. The teachers are responsible on such a high level that they receive a greater judgment. So when you see this, we're talking about teachers. People in leadership teaching positions should not be taking advantage of those that are weaker, like the widows, okay, and eat up their houses, make big showy things to, you know, remember the beginning of this chapter was those who were walking in the marketplace to be seen by men and exalt themselves. And all of this to be seen by men, that was back in verse 5? Yeah. So in verse 5, it said, they do all their works to be seen by men, in the same chapter. So we're seeing how the, hey, remember, we've talked about this a lot during the Midrash. Context, context, context. The context of this chapter, all the way through where we're going to end, is all about self-aggrandizing, self-exalting, to be seen by men. It's not the humble servant. It's the opposite. It's hypocrisy. So continuing here. So let's understand that when you start jumping into these places, there's a greater judgment. Because of this, you will receive a greater judgment. Just going to read you a verse out of James chapter 3. You can hold your place here, but I'll just read the verse to you. Because this is the verse that comes where this greater judgment thing comes from that I keep quoting. So in James chapter 3 and in verse 1, it says, not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, knowing that we shall receive greater judgment. That's the verse. Yaakov, James, he's telling us, look, you should not all desire to become teachers. You should understand that there's greater judgment. Now, if you're called to be a teacher, you can't help yourself. You're going to be a teacher. Now, some of you can't help yourself, but it's because you're emotionally driven because of the wrong motives we already talked about, because you're emotionally invested. See, people ask me how I ended up in ministry. I said, because Abba in his mercy gave me people that actually wanted to hear me talk. I wore out everybody else before that. My wife will tell you, she had friends come over, boom, I would just start, you know. So I wasn't trying to get him onto any pet doctrine. I was just teaching everything and anything. So in his mercy, he gave me you guys. Thank you for showing up, by the way. Thank you for participating. Okay, so back to Matthew 23. Matthew 23 and verse 15. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, because you go about the land and the sea to win one convert, and when he is won, you make him a son of Gehenna twofold, more than yourselves. Okay, so these people in their hypocrisy had a zealousness to gather, to disciple people to their hypocritical walk. Remember, this is the walk that goes back to the first one we read in verse 13 that had to do with not going in and not allowing to go in. So here they are, going out seeking converts to their way of their tunnel vision mindset that's very personal to them. Back to the not letting in and not going in themselves. He says, so you go and you go anywhere, you'll travel across the land and the sea to win over one convert to what? Not a convert to the truth, a convert to Yeshua. A convert to my way of seeing it. That's what they're thinking. I'm going to win you over to be on my team so we're going to worship him my way in the way I see things and keep my calendar, and we're going to observe this is what they're doing. He says, but in doing this, when you've won them over, all you've done is made them a son of Gehenna twofold more than yourself. Okay, so what's Gehenna? See, Gehenna is a valley, the valley of Hinnom, where that was the garbage dump. So what did you do? You made him a son of the garbage. So you're throwing him into the garbage heap with the fire that never stops burning. Okay? And so you're thinking you did such a great thing. No, they think they're like on this luxury island with all the wonderful things perfect, and meanwhile they're laying in a garbage heap. But you've painted it a picture of it being this beautiful thing. It's almost like a Hollywood studio set from the old days where it was just a front of a painted board, but it looked like a house, but behind it was nothing. It was just a front board. Meanwhile, they're in the garbage heap. See, I've mentioned over and over again, that's why systems like Christianity are so dangerous, is because they convince you you're in the truth completely when you're only in it partially. I'm not going to say they're not in it at all, but there's a partial. And so now you really feel safe and comfortable because it's right here, this verse. They've made converts of you, but you've already thrown them in the garbage heap. And they're eating the pig, and they're doing pagan stuff at the Christmas and the Easter and whatever, and they don't know. And so he says, you've done this to them. You've made them a son of Gehenna twofold more than yourself. Terrible stuff. Verse 16. Woe to you, you blind guides. Ooh, now we got a little bit of a different sense here. It's not just the hypocrisy. It's blind guides who say, whoever swears by the dwelling place, it does not matter. But whoever swears by the gold of the dwelling place is bound by oath. Fools and blind, which is greater, the gold or the dwelling place that sets the gold apart? And whoever swears by the altar, it does not matter, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it is bound by an oath. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sets the gift apart? He then who swears by the altar swears by it and by all that is upon it. And he who swears by the dwelling place swears by it and by him who is dwelling in it. And he who swears by the heaven swears by the throne of Elohim and by him who is sitting upon it. Now, remember, we're going to look at verse 23 in a little bit here, and it goes back to, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. So we're not changing subjects here. There's something now that we need to learn about hypocrisy, is that it has also to do with blindness and foolishness. See, it's adding more to the discussion. It's not like, okay, time out. I want to teach something else, and we'll get back to this hypocrisy thing in 2 minutes. It's in the middle for a reason. because it's connected and it's important. And so here we see him talking about this swearing on the item and not understanding the thing that the item is actually there that sets it apart. The verses here, we see in verse 17, 24, and 26, it talks about blindness and fools. The Greek for blind is tuflos, which means opaque, kind of like smoky, as if it's smoky. By analogy, it means blind physically or mentally. Or we could even say spiritually. Okay, there's a blindness here. So in other words, we've been told, I know you've heard the verses where it says, we see through the glass dimly or darkly, like the smoky glass. We can't really see clearly through it. You should also know that in the curses of Deuteronomy 28, we're told that we're going to be groping around in the middle of the day as if it's night, like a blind person. And so that's the same thing as seeing through the glass darkly. In other words, you don't really see what you're supposed to see because it's unclear. There's too much blocking your vision. By the way, that's part of the punishment that we were told in Deuteronomy. And so here we have a blindness, and then we're told that there's this foolishness as well. It says the Greek translated fool is moros, which means dull or stupid. This is where you also get moron. You know, that's why we call people a moron, which we shouldn't be doing. But when you say as a kid, oh, you're a moron. Well, it means because there's a foolishness to it. Okay? There's a foolishness to the person's behavior. A dullness or stupidness, as if shut up. Okay? So from a medical, technical point, I'm guessing that has to do with the fact that there's a dullness there and there's something is shut up in the head and cannot really work right. Heedless, morally, like the word here is a blockhead or appearing absurd, foolishness. And so a blind fool is one of the father. I want us to understand now. So this blindness, this foolishness that they're exhibiting here, fools and blind, is one who the father has given eyes to see, yet chooses not to walk in accordance with what they've seen. And I say that because this foolishness and blindness is in the middle of the section about hypocrisy. And so this is not just a foolish person who doesn't know better or a blind person that really can't see. Otherwise, it would make no sense to stick that in the middle of this thing about hypocrisy. And so there's got to be some hypocrisy that's causing the foolishness and the blindness. And so I hope we can understand as we're going through this now. He says, look, you fools, you blind. In other words, you should know better. He gave you the eyes to see, but you're not seeing. You're choosing not to. And so we see this going on. And by the way, this goes back to Mark chapter 7. So let's go there and we can see this sort of broken down in Mark chapter 7. This is a chapter you're probably all taught in Christianity is why you can eat anything you want. Of course, that's not what the chapter's about. By the way, that's hypocrisy. To take this chapter, which is clearly has a reason to exist, and turn it into something that has nothing to do with what it's about. Okay? There's absolutely zero in Mark chapter 7 here that has anything to do with food, except that it's being used for an analogy. And that's the important thing that we understand. So in Mark chapter 7, let's just begin for a second at the beginning of the chapter. It says, the Pharisees and some of the scribes assembled to him, having come from Jerusalem, and seeing some of his taught ones eat bread with defiled, that is, unwashed hands, they found fault. So what are they eating? Bread. They're eating bread. Not eating meat, not eating lobster, shrimp, pork. No, bread. All of this discussion is going to come from the fact that they did not wash their hands a certain way before eating the bread. So it's not about food. It's about the ritual. It says, verse 3, for the Pharisees and all the Yehudim, the Jews, do not eat unless they wash their hands thoroughly, holding fast the tradition of the elders. Now, the word thoroughly, I don't think is translated correctly. There's a ritual that the Jews do called Netilat Yadayim. It's got other names as well. Where they take water and a pan, and they actually take the water and they pour once over the left, once over the right, once over the left, once over the right. It's a ritual washing. If you've ever been to a Jewish home to do Passover, and before the Seder. That's one of the blessings that said, and the lady of the house will walk around to the men specifically with a towel over arm and the basin and the pitcher, and they'll put their hands out and wash. And they'll say the blessing for Nitilat Yadayim, for the blessing for the washing of the hands. Notice what it says here, though. This is the tradition of the elders. What was being talked about in Matthew 23? A tradition. It says, you guys say that a pledge that's made this way doesn't mean anything, but if it's made this way, it means everything. We're going to see that that's the same issue going on here in Mark chapter 7. So it's a tradition problem. Okay? He says, verse 4, he says, and coming from the marketplace, they don't eat unless they wash, and there are many other traditions which they had received and hold fast, the washing of cups and utensils, etc., etc. Okay. So then the Pharisee and scribe asked him, saying, why do your students, your taught ones, not walk according to these traditions, the traditions of the elders, but they eat bread with unwashed hands? Now, we have context now. So everything that flows out of this is to answer the question about why they're not doing this elders' tradition. The discussion is not about Torah. Not about the instructions from God. There's no issue here. It says, why don't they keep the commandments? It doesn't say that. It says, why are they not doing the tradition? Now, what you will not see as we go through the rest of this piece here that we're going to read, you will not see him tell you that the tradition is wrong. You won't see that because he never says it. But you're going to hear him explain what can be wrong with traditions. But he's also telling you that traditions in themselves are not bad. Because if that would have been the case, he would have said, well, it's a stupid tradition. You're not supposed to wash your hands and do this ritual and everything. He doesn't say that. What he does say is that you've missed the point. And he's going to use the word hypocrite. So in the next verse, in verse 6, he says, answering them, he said to them, well did Yeshayahu, Isaiah, prophesy concerning you hypocrites. As it has been written, this people respect me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they do worship me, teaching as Torah, teaching as instructions from the Almighty, the commands of men. So problem number one is when, this is the hypocrisy. Remember we talked about this already, you know, maybe 20, 30 minutes ago, that the leaven hypocrisy is when we're attributing something to him that's not him. But we're going to treat it like it's from him. He said, look, you're teaching the teachings of men and claiming it's the teachings of Yahweh. Now, that doesn't mean just because it's a teaching of men that it makes it wrong. What's wrong in this particular case is teaching it as if it's Torah, as if it's Yahweh's teachings. We have lots of great traditions. Almost every family, if not every family, has its own little traditions that their family does that maybe other families don't do. And it's passed down through generations, and that's good. But they're just traditions. So he says, look, as long as you don't turn it into Torah, I'll give you an example. Almost all of you pray before you eat. There's no commandment to do that. It's a good tradition. But I've seen some people smack their children who started to eat before they prayed. Let's de-escalate that a little bit. They did break a tradition, and they were maybe disrespectful of your instruction, but make sure you're not treating it as if they sinned or something. Do you understand what I'm saying? You may still need to discipline them because they need to respect your decisions and your traditions. But be careful you don't elevate the tradition to make it Torah. That's where we end up in trouble. Do not elevate your traditions. That's what he's saying here. And actually, he's only quoting Isaiah. He's quoting Yeshayahu. He's not even saying it from his own self. He's quoting it from Isaiah. Okay, let's continue. Verse 8 says, forsaking the command of Elohim, you hold fast the tradition of men. Now he's going to talk about the next part of the problem. Not only do you sometimes elevate a tradition and call it of Yahweh when it's not, he says, but you use your tradition to undermine or override a commandment of Yahweh. That's what's going on in Matthew 23. That's what he's talking about when he talks about using a pledge sworn over money given to the temple to override the pledge sworn by the altar to the dwelling place itself. So this is essentially a way of making an excuse to break the Torah. So look at what he says here. He says, look, he said to them, well, do you set aside the, he said, do you set aside the command of Elohim in order to guard your tradition? He's not saying that's good, by the way. He's saying, well, do you do that? Do you set aside the command of Elohim to guard your tradition? For Moshe said, respect your father and your mother. And he who curses father and mother, let him be put to death. But you say, if a man says to his father and mother, whatever profit, what inheritance I have, you might have received from me is korban. Korban means it's an offering. It's a gift at the altar. He says, you no longer let them do any matter at all for their father and mother. So here you have some children that hate their parents and say, I don't have any obligation to take care of you because what I was supposed to use to take care of you, I gave it at the altar. And he's saying, when you have that tradition, it interferes with the Torah command. The Torah command says you have to honor mother and father. You have an obligation to take care for them, take care of them when they need it at the end. He says, but you say, and we're back to verse 11 here. He says, but you say if a man says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is korban, he says, you no longer let him do any matter at all for his father or his mother. Nullifying the word of Elohim through your tradition, which you have handed down, and many such traditions you have. This is the problem. The problem is that the tradition nullifies, interferes with, overrides, undermines a Torah command. It's not a good tradition. It's actually a big problem. And it's hypocrisy. When you start using traditions of men to undermine the instructions of our Creator, now you've got a big problem. Now you have a big problem. Okay, back to Matthew 23. In verse 23. Okay, so hopefully you understand when he talks about them being fools and blind, it's a voluntary foolishness and blindness where they're choosing their self-exalted way of doing things over what Yahweh actually said. And in doing so, they're leading many astray. They're not entering in and not allowing others to enter in. They're exalting themselves. And they're going to receive greater judgment. This is not where you want to be. Verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites! Because you tithe the mint and the anise and the cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of Torah, the right ruling and the compassion and belief. They need to have been done without neglecting the others. Now notice what he says here. He didn't say that tithing was wrong. He said that was good, but you focus so big on that. Why don't you focus on the things that are weightier? You see, tithing is basic. Tithing is very basic. It's very simple. Doesn't require anybody but you. You don't have to interact with anybody to do it. You don't have to even interact with Yahweh to do it. You just take your increase and you take 10% of it. You put it aside and that's it. It's not that difficult. It's basic. It's simple. But when it comes to the right ruling and compassion and the belief, this is much more difficult. This takes a change in you, in your character, in how you treat other people. Because I think we can all agree that you can tithe and still be a miserable you-know-what. Whatever that is, right? You can. You can treat people horribly. You can give the Creator zero time. Hey, but I gave my money. Matter of fact, that could be a prideful thing, because what if you're wealthy? You'd be like, oh, well, listen, I give my money. I can promise you right now, there's not a ministry around that's never heard a person who didn't get their way go, But I put my money in the box. What do you mean telling me I can't have my way? Like somehow putting their money in the box should influence the leadership. And you probably have heard people say that. Maybe you've said it yourself. If you did, shame on you. Because the leadership shouldn't be swayed by whether you put money in the box or not, and neither does that give you leverage on anything. That's basic. That's simple. He says, but don't neglect that. Make sure you're doing that, but don't neglect the weightier things. He says, these need to have been done without neglecting the others. So in the hypocrisy, what have they done? They've elevated something that really was simple and basic higher than that which is most critical. But they should not neglect either of them. And so he's saying, why would you neglect the weightier things? Weightier meaning heavier, they're harder, they're more challenging. They take more effort. Oh, but you're meticulous to make sure you've tithed over every leaf of an herb. Could you imagine counting the herb leaves in every tenth one? And that's what he's trying to make a point of. You're so detailed on these little things, but these big things you completely ignore. And look for yourself. How is that in your life? Is there any area where that is you? We have this big problem. He says, verse 24, he says, blind guides. So now he's talking about, remember, the blind and foolish, that self, and he's connecting in the teaching part. He says, you're guiding people. In other words, they're watching you, or you're teaching them by example and by word and deed. He says, and you're guiding them. He says, look, you're straining out a gnat. Imagine you have a tiny little gnat in your food and using a strainer to strain out that gnat, because you don't want that tiny little gnat, which you can hardly see, to be in your food so you'd eat it. But then you swallow a camel. It's a powerful metaphor. He says, here you are. You're so upset by that tiny little bug that you wouldn't even notice if you swallowed it, because you can't even hardly see it to strain it out. But yet, you're sitting there swallowing a camel. And you're teaching others to do the same thing. You're teaching others to follow exactly what you're doing. This is horrible. This is horrible. Luke, you don't have to turn that, but Luke 11:42 parallels this, and it says it slightly differently, but it has the same meaning. Okay. So are you straining out gnats and swallowing camels? You know? Some of you, because you're not... It's almost like you're back to the widows. You have that sort of weaker part of you that's more susceptible, where you're not so much swallowing camels, but you're swallowing anything, doctrinally, positionally, whoever gets a hand on you and they influence you. That's the swaying by every wind of doctrine, almost. Whoever's in front of you and is most impressive at the moment, that's where you're headed, until you meet the next person who redirects you in another direction. And that's not, there's no stability in that. Verse 25. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, because you clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are filled with plunder and unrighteousness. Blind Pharisee, remember again, this is voluntary blindness, first clean the inside of the cup and dish so that the outside of them becomes clean too. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly indeed look well, but inside they're filled with dead men's bones and all kinds of uncleanness. See the hypocrisy here. So I go and I wash the dish, and I wash the outside of it. I haven't washed any of the inside of it. I go, here, it's a clean cup. And you look inside going, no, I don't think so. Again, it's like the facade that I said about, like a Hollywood set. You may know this yourself, can put on a pretty good show and look okay on the outside when the whole inside is a mess. Because I've had some of you come to me, and this isn't to pick on you, actually, this is to understand that you want to not necessarily let people know how messed up you are when you're in person and you're out in public, but then you come and you go, you may not know this from looking at me because I carry myself so well, I've been practicing this for years, but I'm a mess and I need help. Now, I understand that there are some social advantages to being able to put on a good front, a good face. But there's also an hypocrisy where you now start convincing yourself that you're okay when you're not okay. So I'm not condemning those of you that can come to a social activity where there's going to be other people and you can put on that good face. Actually, that's probably a good thing that you do that. It's good for people not to have to be brought down and brought into your maelstrom of whatever mess you have going on. But then be careful you don't convince yourself you're okay when you're not okay. Because you could be so good at pretending that you convince yourself. And that's a trap. And then you're walking in hypocrisy. And so I do want to encourage you, before that happens, you're going to want to go find counsel. And be able to say, I need to open up all that mess and get it cleaned out. You know, one of the great things that we're starting to get done in our men's fellowship, because we have a little men's thing that we started locally, and we're going to hopefully get this going on in different places that MTY has congregations, is the men are opening up about their stuff. And I don't want to say I'm amazed, but I really appreciate the vulnerability that the men are trusting each other enough to deal with their stuff. Because men, worse than the women, don't want to deal with their stuff. They do not want anybody to know they have stuff to deal with. Oh, no, I'm good. I'm fine. It's hard. I'm a man. I got everything under control. I can't let you know I'm a total disaster mess and I have no idea what's going on and I'm out of control. And so then we walk in hypocrisy. If we don't get that cleaned out, if we're going to walk around with an outside that's clean and inside that's a mess, but you know what? If you clean the inside, the outside automatically gets clean and looks clean. Because you'll do what you need to the outside when the inside is good. But you know what? Sometimes the inside is so messed up, we start seeing it on the outside. We see it on your face. We see it in your body language. We might even see it in the way you dress because it's not the way you normally used to dress. And you start not taking care of yourself because you're just so messed up. It's almost like when we did, and it's actually coming up when we get back, you know, Tazria and Metzorah. Those Torah portions deal with the leprosy, the tzara'at. Which is really not exactly like a leprosy, but. And so you have a skin blemish. But you know what? If that doesn't get dealt with, sometimes it then ends up on the clothing. And if that doesn't get dealt with, it ends up on the walls of your house. In other words, eventually whatever it is that you're doing that you shouldn't be doing becomes visible. You can only hide it for so long. Because Abba's going to bring out, he says, everything that's hidden will be exposed, will be brought to light. And so we have to deal with these things. He says, you're like whitewashed tombs. Outwardly, indeed, you look well, but inside, you're all dead men's bones and all kinds of uncleanness. He says, you outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside, you're filled with all kinds of hypocrisy and lawlessness. You know, we want to be good and not be so concerned about looking good. That's, again, back to that self-exalting, self-focused thing. I don't mean just looking good, meaning that you dress up and look good. I mean, but where people can say, hey, I'm impressed with what he does. And then people think you're great and look at what you do. But meanwhile, when you're not in public, it's a whole nother story. A lot of husbands and wives know that they're like, I can't tell my friends. They won't believe me because when he or she is in public, they're a totally different person. And so when you try to tell somebody, but no, that's not who they are. That's who they are out here. But when I get home, it's Jekyll and Hyde. It's a whole different deal. Some of you had pastors like that who, you know, they were in church and they were in front of the microphone and all this stuff was one thing, but you got them away from the podium, not the same person. Now, some of you can tell by when I teach some of the things I say, I don't watch my tongue as much maybe as I should have, but I'm the same person here as if you're talking to me away from the microphone. And so whatever I'd say out there is likely to come across over here. Now, that's not to say anything and be proud of and bad. That means that whatever good or bad that I am, you're getting a real person. Okay? And some of you have seen me in situations where I've lost my temper or I've been a real person in front of you. But that could be anywhere the same. It's not like some places I just always have it completely under control for appearances. But some of us are really good at that. Let's see. Okay, so he says, because you built tombs of the prophets. Okay, we're now in verse 29. Where do you scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites? Because you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous and say, if we had lived in those days, the days of our fathers, we would have taken part with them. We would, excuse me, not taking part with them in the blood of the prophets. Oh, we would have acted differently. Look, some of you would be throwing rocks at Yeshua for eating with the publicans, the tax collectors and the sinners. Like, oh, look at what they're doing. Because you're doing that now. You're pointing at people and saying, oh, look at what they're doing. Well, you don't know what they're doing. You don't even know why they're there. You're making assumptions and you don't know. Especially if it's leadership that may be meeting with somebody for a reason. But you might be around with those guys that were pointing the finger even at Yeshua. Because he did things that you would not have thought were right. They didn't think it was right when he ate with them, tax collectors, the sinners. As they were judging him, they were calling him a glutton and a drunkard because he was hanging out with those guys. He said, but I'm the great physician and these guys are sick. The well don't need a physician. He says, verse 31, thus you bear witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who did murder the prophets, and you fill up the measure of your fathers. Serpents, brood of adders, how would you escape the judgment of Gehenna? Because of this sea I send you prophets, wise men, scholars of the scriptures. Some of them you shall kill and impale, and some of them you shall flog in the congregations and persecute from city to city. You know, there are still people out there that are attacking some really good teachers because those really good teachers don't agree with them. And that's what this is about. If you're in your self-exalting, everybody needs to agree with me mode, and if the teachers out there are teaching don't agree with you, think of it this way. I have had and made some points that I disagree with some things that other people do. Everybody does. Okay? But what you don't see is the mocking and the attacking and the ridiculing that you see from some of the teachers who were where we are now, went off on one of these side routes, and now they're going to attack you and mock you. And I know the teachers are doing this because their students are doing this. You understand what I'm talking about? Have you had anybody have, any of you have friends that have gone to a different way of keeping the Sabbath? Anybody get mocked by them for not going where they go? Or a different way of keeping the calendar, or a different way of understanding whatever. That's the problem. The fruit is in their behavior. Okay, even if they're right, they're wrong. Because if it's going to cause them to treat people the way they're doing it, the fruit's wrong. So there must be something wrong there. That doesn't mean the doctrinal position by default is wrong. But the teaching and the leadership that they're learning from is teaching them to behave in a wrong way. So even if their doctrinal position is right, you can't even listen to it because it's so wrongly being delivered. That's hypocrisy as well. That goes back to the not entering in and not letting others enter in. Oh, well, all those people out there that don't see this thing about whatever it is that we see, well, they're all wrong, and we need to pick on them and attack them if they don't listen to us. So go out there and straighten out all your friends, and if they don't receive it, then just tell them how stupid they are and mock them. I counsel people every day that are being attacked that way. It's not good. It's not good. All right. So hypocrisy, as we see in this section here from verse 25 to about 34, is an outward appearance that's contrary to an inward truth. It's contrary to an inward truth. And so this is what we need to understand. We have to make sure that our outward appearance is congruent with the inward reality. And so if the inward reality is not right, let's get it fixed. Let's counsel and get it fixed so that we're not walking in hypocrisy. And may Abba bring us more people that are qualified to counsel. Because I know a lot of you, the reason you're in trouble is you know you need counsel and you're getting counsel from all the wrong people. And they only make it worse. And then eventually someone will call me up and they're a complete mess now, basket case, crying on the phone, distraught, because they took counsel from somebody they didn't even know. Let me ask you a question. How foolish and stupid, if the shoe fits, I'm sorry, but I'm upset, must you be to take counsel from someone you don't know? I mean, yeah, you met him on Facebook, or you kind of somehow connected through some internet thing. You read a few posts they made. You've sent some text or Facebook messaging back and forth. And now you're going to let them speak into your life and offer you counsel? And then you're going to call me after it blows up in your face, and now I got to clean that all up. Why would you do that? You shouldn't listen to anybody, including me, unless you had a relationship enough with that person to know that they love you and care about you and that they're qualified to offer counsel. Why would you let anybody guide you? He already warns us about blind guides. People who are voluntarily not seeing because they have exaltation issues and they got their own agendas and now they're going to try to convince everybody of that agenda. You know, that teaching I did on divorce and remarriage and putting away, I did that teaching because there were people I was running into that were murdering people over their fact that they'd been divorced and remarried. And I wanted to set the record straight for what Scripture says about it, but I know a few people specifically that literally, if they met you and they found out you were divorced are remarried, you are getting an onslaught of that you are in sin. As if it was their job to judge you. And even if you were in sin, which I don't, you know, you have to listen to the teaching to understand, they're not there. They should not be there to try to wreck your current situation. Because some of you were in abusive, horrible, nightmare marriages, and now you're in a wonderful, loving, Torah-observant marriage. Oh, so we should just throw that all out because somebody's opinion through Christianity misunderstood Scripture and told you now you're in sin because you were divorced at some point. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you got to listen to the teaching. But what I'm talking about here is the idea of these people getting counsel from those who don't know you and you don't know them. But you're so desperate, you'll listen to anybody almost. But the funny thing is, you'll listen to the anybody's, but you won't come to me because you have an issue with leadership or you have a fear of... this other foolishness is going on that needs to be dealt with. So you won't come to a leader that you're really under their covering because of all those issues. So what do? You do something even twice as dumb. You go to somebody that has no qualifications and you don't know it all. And I'm not mocking you. I feel that that's coming out of your pain. You do this because you're so desperate and you're frustrated. But please overcome the fears and go to and seek proper qualified counsel. Otherwise, they're not going in and neither are you. Because that's kind of what's going on in here. And they're going to just teach you to walk in that hypocrisy and that false understanding. They're blind guides leading people right into that garbage pit. So let's not do that. All right, the bottom line, contrary to what we may have always been told, leaven does not represent sin, but rather leaven represents hypocrisy and voluntary blindness in our approach to Torah, which then results in sin. And I guess we'll have to finish the rest on Monday. Let's pray. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. Father, we come before you. And Father, we want to stop and pause. And we really want to understand this leaven thing. We want to understand what it is that we're allowing to come in that's a transformative element, that's an element that produces alteration and transformation. Now, we understand that there's also things that say the kingdom of heaven is like leaven. And in that case, that's a good transformation. But the leaven that you warn us about is the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes, this hypocrisy. And so, Father, help us to look for all of these things. So we don't hear you say, woe unto you, you hypocrite. We don't get called fools and blind. We don't get called blind guides. But help us to seek and search out all that leaven and get it out of our lives so that we can be unleavened. And then we can bring in the altering, changing factor that is the mind of Yeshua, the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, and be transformed and conformed into the image of the Son. And not be just transformed and conformed into the world or some hybrid, partial, in-out hypocrisy thing. Father, we can't do this without your help. We are so overwhelmed, abused, neglected, confused, and just... we're a mess. Father, help us to lead us to true leaders. Lead us to true counselors. Lead us to true ministry that you have put in place that can help us. Father, we thank you for those that you put in place and ask that you would give us the strength and the courage to meet with them and to hear what they would have to say and stop listening to all those that are unqualified. We thank you, we praise you, and we ask all of this in the name above all names, Yeshua our Messiah. Amen. Amen.
Thanks for listening to Now is the Time with Steve Berkson here on Hebrew Nation Radio. Now is the Time Radio is a production of MTOI, Messianic Torah Observant Israel. For more information, visit MTOI.org.